Headlines: Ayatollah Khamenei says the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than the ill-informed individuals or hired agents who are stirring up the riots. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified attacks on Kurdish militants there. Also coming up, Ukraine's president says Russia missile strikes have left millions of households without power. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. Our top story: Iran's leader says the country's main area of confrontation today goes beyond the recent rioting and unrest, stressing that global arrogance is the main enemy. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran's enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of the country. That's because, he added, they want to have dominance over the minds of the Iranian people. The leader rejected negotiations with the U.S. to resolve disputes. He said that the negotiations will not solve any problems unless by paying ransom or crossing the red lines of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei also said the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution tipped the balance against the favor of arrogant powers in the West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. Iran's leader made the comments in a meeting with a group of besieged forces in Tehran. Hakima Zaghai Bria is an academic and political analyst. She joined us earlier with her take on the speech delivered by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Besiege Week.
When you look at U.S. history of relations with other countries, you see that the United States looks at the countries around the world in as one of two cases. One is a client country and the other is an enemy country. An enemy is a country that systematically acts independent of the United States, doesn't want to give ransom to the United States, and looks for its own interests rather than trying to take care of the interests of the United States in its region. That is the role that the clients play. Now, Iran, with its revolution, became one of the main enemies of the United States. That is not what we did, but that is what in United States' eyes, Iran becomes an enemy just by having a revolution that makes it independent. So here, there are two scenarios. One is that a country is weak enough for the United States to be able to overthrow it, as you know, the United States has done in some countries where they had revolutions. For example, in Congo, they had a revolution. They had an independence from the Belgians. And then over a period of 1 year, you know, they had a coup and they removed Patrice Lumumba and they killed him and everything was over, okay? And they had a friendly government, so to speak. But sometimes you have a country like Iran, which is more resilient, that doesn't, old tactics sometimes don't work. So you need to have a step-by-step and a more hybrid scenario for dealing with that country. And that is what has happened with Iran, that from the beginning, many different, instruments have been used. One of them is negotiations, so to call. But I would like to say that it is not negotiations, but it is coercive diplomacy.
Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this goal, which has repeatedly been decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said Turkey carried out new raids on the northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strikes since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on the Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. They have denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. Independent political analyst Mohammed Hassan Dabl says Turkey's attacks on Syria are a serious threat to peace and stability in the region.
This is really a serious concern for the region in terms of peace and stability. As you know, the ethnic spillover, the effect of this war will have the consequences could not be imagined. It could lead to an all-out war. It could even involve Iran to take actions in support of the Syrians. They are taking advantage at the moment of the current situation where Russia, that had a lot of influence over in Syria, is at the moment involved in the Ukraine war, and Turkey is taking advantage of that, trying to expand its influence in the northern Syrian areas.
The Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts amid Russia's missile onslaught. Volodymyr Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital, Kiev, and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv, and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and a further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure are intended to harm civilians. That makes them a war crime. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, gives details on how the critical situation in Ukraine, including massive blackouts, is affecting the lives of people there.
They're reaching chaotic levels now, the situation for Ukrainian people. Power out in large parts of the country, huge problems with water. The situation is critical, according to Ukrainian officials. And as you say, this may well cause another major refugee crisis into Western Europe. Russia trying to bring Ukraine to its knees, trying to bring it to the negotiating table by making it impossible for the Ukrainian government to look to provide even the most basic necessities to their people, and it could cause significant loss of life, particularly if it starts affecting hospitals. Now, will Ukraine be able to sustain these attacks on the energy infrastructure? The president's wife recently went on television saying that Ukrainians are willing and able to live without water and electricity for 2 to 3 years. She cited a survey which said 90% of respondents said so. It's also important to recognize that Ukraine has become an intensely repressive state. It's banned all independent media. It's banned most political parties. It has a very large and active intelligence agency, the SBU. It has far-right extremist military battalions that round up government critics, particularly pro-Russian critics, and often kills them. That's been well reported even by mainstream press now. So a combination of that kind of determination, genuine determination by Ukrainian people, and an intensely repressive state means that Ukraine may well be able to sustain these attacks on its infrastructure.
NATO's chief says it's up to Germany to decide if it wants to supply Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems to Ukraine following a request by Poland.
We have also provided significant air defense systems to Ukraine, including with modern systems. Germany has provided modern air defense systems to Ukraine, and I will, at the foreign ministerial meeting next week, urge allies to further step up the support, not least with air defense to Ukraine. But specific decisions on specific capabilities, that remains national decisions.
Stoltenberg was referring to talks between NATO members Germany and Poland over the Patriot air defense system. Berlin offered to deploy the US-made system in Poland after a stray missile hit a Polish village near Ukraine's border last week. But Warsaw told Germany to ship the system to Ukraine instead to help it fight against Russia. On Thursday, German officials said the Patriot units were intended for use in NATO territory, Berlin further insisted that any use of the weapons outside of this area would need prior discussions with NATO allies. Germany has already cautioned that NATO should not become a participant in the Ukraine conflict with Russia while trying to strengthen Kiev's defenses. Political commentator Digby James Wren says Germany doesn't want to be seen actively supporting the continuation of the conflict in Ukraine.
Germany is on the side generally that they're looking for negotiations, and those negotiations need to be between Russia and the US, not Russia and Ukraine. And the second thing is that they're also trying to shift the responsibility to NATO per se directly, or even to the US. Germany doesn't want to be seen to be fueling more fighting. Germany is in effect trying to push the responsibility to NATO and therefore to Washington. It doesn't want to be seen as actively supporting continuation of conflict on the ground in Ukraine. And I think that Scholz is, in his recent meetings in China and with the G20 and so forth, they definitely want to go towards a negotiated peace. And the only way this can happen is if Washington speaks directly with Russia. And I think the Germans are trying to push that responsibility publicly mm-hmm. to Washington and to try and catalyze negotiations.
Rights groups have accused the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek-Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to a Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Staying in the European continent, nurses in Britain are planning a strike for next month as their demands for a pay increase have been turned down by the government. The strike by the Royal College of Nursing Union would be the first in its 106-year history. Nurses from England, Wales and Northern Ireland will be walking out on December 15th and the 20th. They're demanding a pay rise that would help them through the cost of living crisis plaguing the UK families. This is how British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak reacted to the demands of the healthcare workers.
what the unions are asking for, I think, is a 19% pay rise. And I think most people watching will recognise that that's obviously unaffordable. And that's why I'm pleased that the health secretary is sitting down, talking to the union, and hopefully we can find a way through this.
Sunak acknowledged the difficult situation that healthcare workers and everyone else in the UK are going through as a result of the unprecedented inflation. He stressed that his plans outlined last week will rein in soaring prices and calm the economy. The planned strikes by the nurses would be the latest in a series of walkouts by tens of thousands of other union workers in various sectors. They're struggling to get by as the UK grapples with a 40-year high inflation rate of 11.1%.
150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months. The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reason. Saeed Purizap, London.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Democracy is under threat in the U.S. Even the midterm elections could leave democracy weaker ahead of the 2024 presidential race. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of Common Dreams wrote, The Guardian reported this week on the efforts of tech billionaire Peter Thiel to influence U.S. politics. It's an important piece about more than just this election cycle. Thiel's power shows that Citizens United has done to U.S. democracy. With 3 weeks to go until Election Day, outside groups have already spent some $1.3 billion to influence the outcome of the midterms. Thiel's nearly $30 million in donations account for only a fraction of that nearly unbelievable total, but he represents a very specific kind of influencer. As Kristen Lee told The Guardian, since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. Billionaires are sponsoring candidates like prized racehorses. The situation is worrying, exceedingly worrying, but not unprecedented. During the Gilded Age, moneyed corporate interests held incredible sway over the U.S. government. Senators who represented the copper-rich state of Montana, for example, were referred to as representing copper rather than representing their constituents or the state itself. Copper magnate William A. Clark bought himself a seat in the Senate by plying the state's legislators, who at the time elected U.S. senators with massive financial gifts. Once Clark's corrupt practices were revealed, his 1889 opponent, also revealingly a copper magnate, worked to have him removed from Congress. Clark came back in 1901, defeating, you guessed it, another wealthy mine owner to win a Senate seat. The citizens of Montana finally took their government back in 1912, enacting a law that barred corporations from intervening financially in elections. That law stood for a century, until the Supreme Court struck it down and, inconsistent with Citizens United, decided in 2010. Shortly after the Citizens United ruling, President Obama asked Americans to imagine the power this will give a special interest over politicians. We don't have to imagine anymore, we are living it. Thiel is a particularly alarming example. Through massive donations to super PACs, which Citizens United brought to the fore, he's using his riches to force his fringe views into mainstream political discourse. He's supporting candidates who spread the false claim that fraud decided the 2020 election, and his money doesn't just force a certain type of candidate into the public eye. It also silences Thiel's ideological opponents. By working to defeat the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump, for example, Thiel has deterred others from speaking out against the former president. Few politicians can afford to ignore Thiel and the threat his money holds. We don't have to continue down this road. Many groups, including Brennan Center, have proposed legislation to limit billionaires' influence over elections without running afoul of Citizens United. We don't need a billionaire's approval like the people of Montana did in 1912. Americans can exercise the power they have as citizens and take back the U.S. government. Also, Guardian wrote, Peter Thiel is far from the first billionaire who has wielded his fortune to try to influence the course of American politics. But in an election year when democracy itself is set to be on the ballot, he stands out for assailing a long-standing governing system that he has described as deranged and in urgent need of course correction. The German-born investor and tech entrepreneur, a Silicon Valley disruptor who helped found PayPal alongside Elon Musk, and made his fortune as one of the earliest investors in Facebook, has catapulted himself into the top ranks of mega donor class by pouring close to $30 million this year's midterm elections. He's not merely favoring one party over another by supporting candidates who deny the legitimacy of Joe Biden's election as president and have, in their different ways, called for the pillars of the American establishment to be toppled entirely. Thiel's priorities this midterm cycle have partly aligned with those of Donald Trump, with whom he has had an on-again, off-again relationship since writing him a $1.25 million check during the 2016 presidential campaign. Thiel, like Trump, has made it his business to end the careers of what he calls the traitorous 10 Republican House members who voted to impeach Trump in the wake of the January 6th insurrection. Four of these members opted not to run for re-election at all, and four more, including Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the House committee investigating January 6th, went down in the primaries. But there are also signs that Thiel is thinking around and beyond the former president. The lion's share of his largest, $28 million and counting, has been directed towards two business protege who, with his help, have established themselves as Gantley right-wing darlings. J.D. Vance, the best-selling author of the blue-collar memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, who is running for Senate in Ohio, and Blake Masters, a self-styled anti-progressive and anti-globalist who is running for Senate in Arizona. Over the past decade, ever since the Supreme Court dramatically loosened the rules of political campaign, giving in its Citizens United decision, Thiel has placed sizable fortunes on candidates who are not only conservative but have sought to challenge long-standing institutional traditions and break the Republican Party's own norms. Senator Ted Cruz in Texas and Senator Josh Hawley in Missouri, as well as Trump himself. Masters, who has campaigned on the notion that psychopaths are running the country right now and is spoken approvingly of the anti-establishment philosophy of 1990s, Ona Bomber, and Vance, a frequent speaker on the university circuit during his book tour days, who now says universities are the enemy, fit the same mold. They and Thiel all have ties to a branch of the new right known as NatCon, whose adherents believe broadly that the establishment needs to be torn down, much as Thiel and his fellow Silicon Valley disruptors believed 2 decades ago that the future lay in destroying long-standing business models and practices. Thiel himself opined as far back as 2009 that he no longer believed democracy to be compatible with freedom and expressed little hope that voting will make things better. While a member of Trump's presidential transition team in 2016, he flashed his institution-busting instincts by proposing that a leading climate change skeptic, William Happer, be appointed as White House science advisor. He also pushed for a libertarian Bitcoin entrepreneur who did not believe in drug trials to head up the Food and Drug Administration. Such proposals were too much even by Trump's iconoclastic standards. Steve Bannon, Trump's ultra-right campaign manager and political strategist, told a Thiel biographer, "Peter's idea of disrupting government is out there." Thiel did not respond to a request for an interview, and these representatives did not respond to multiple invitations to comment. Masters and Vance also did not respond to inquiries. Chi-Sun Lee, an expert on campaign finance who directs the Brennan Center's elections and government program at New York University, said it does seem to be getting worse. Outside spending in this federal midterm cycle is more than double the last midterm cycle. Since Citizens United, just 12 mega donors, 8 of them billionaires, have paid $1 out of every 13 spent in federal elections. And now we are seeing a troubling new trend that some mega donors are sponsoring campaigns that attack the fundamentals of democracy itself. Till's spending has been dwarfed this year by at least three other mega donors: Soros, $128 million to the Democrats; shipping products tycoon Richard Olhain, $53 million to Republicans; and hedge fund manager Kenneth Griffin, $50 million to Republicans. And Till has some way to go to match the consistent giving cycle after cycle of the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson, the late Las Vegas casino magnate. Many experts also believe the attack on democracy began long before it became as explicit as Till has made it, because the whole point of funneling large amounts of money into the political system is to sway policy away from the will of the majority to the narrow interests of the donors and their friends. This ability to control the policy agenda drives spending even more than the desire to see specific candidates win, says Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, whose 2011 book Republic Lost offers an enduringly devastating analysis of the relationship between money and political influence. And the spending is likely only to increase. You're going to see much, much bigger individual contributions and an acceleration of contributions to super PACs, like the ones established to support Vance and Masters, Lessig said, adding, the candidates and the super PACs can't coordinate on spending, but that doesn't mean they can't coordinate on the fundraising, since the super PACs are outspending candidates by orders of magnitude. It's all a dance to flush money into super PACs. They basically call the shots, and politicians can get anything through that they oppose. Less than a month from the election day, both Vance and Masters are trailing their Democratic opponents in the polls, Vance by less than Masters. But Lessig says it would be wrong to conclude Till or any of the other mega donors are wasting their money. If you're a candidate and you know $10 million is going to come in against you on a particular issue, you are going to bend to avoid the effect of that money, whether or not it's going to decide the race. If you're someone who would otherwise be a strong climate activist, but you know that if you mention a carbon tax, $1 million will drop from some anti-carbon tax super PAC, you won't talk about it, he said. Till's bid to overthrow the system, in other words, goes well beyond his ability to determine which party controls the Senate next year. The money will solidify the notion that the country is being run by psychopaths, at least among a hardcore of Republican voters, analysts warn, and will further harden the ideological battle lines that have split the country in two and made common ground ever harder to find. It also brings the extreme opinions of Nat Confeder into the mainstream, making it easier for radical Republican candidates to run and win in future races, they say. We are at a crisis point here. Not so much because the ideas are hard to defeat, but we don't have a context in which to defeat them, Lessig said, adding, The fact that the same number of people believed the election was stolen as believed it on January 6 is a profound indictment of the information ecology in America. The Brennan Center believes there are ways of improving the system, at least at the state and local level, and points to efforts in both red and blue states to close certain loopholes and introduce public financing models to rein in the influence of the mega donors. Lee said she would also like to see federal legislation to build a meaningful firewall between campaign funds and super PACs. She said the legislation exists, and it would be a constitutional improvement even under the Citizens United ruling. All we need is the political will to act.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UN Human Rights Council has adopted a resolution against Iran over the recent developments in the country. It has called for the formation of a fact-finding mission to investigate what it calls alleged human rights violations related to recent protests in Iran. Tehran has dismissed the move as totally unacceptable, saying the Geneva-based council has once again been exploited to serve the interests of a small group of countries. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the motives of the sponsors of the latest anti-Iran move in the UN, as well as the Western double standards in dealing with the issue of human rights. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. And we also have journalist and political commentator Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who's joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. I want to get your opinion about this resolution adopted by the UN Human Rights Council.
Thank you for having me. It is obviously that the West is dealing with Iran on the basis of double standard. This is not the first time, because the aim of the riots in Iran are far from being a concern about the Iranian population or freedom of the freedom of women in Iran. That is all about to free Iran and to change the regime, as President Joe Biden said, and as before him, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in 2018 said that if the Iranians want to eat, they have to come to the US. So all these steps taken by the Europeans are actually US will to gather a coalition against Iran and say, we are not alone attacking Iran, we are not alone that want to bring Iran back to the negotiation table in Vienna regarding to the nuclear deal without offering guarantee to Iran. They want Iran weak and they want to impose their conditions on Iran, and they want Iran to accept what they want, otherwise they will waive the European narrative that is related to human rights, always against the enemy of the US, but never against their allies that are real dictators, and particularly in the Middle East.
Ms. Kara Mustafa, what's your perspective on Iran's response to the motion?
Well, I think from a Middle Eastern perspective, I think we are sick and tired of this neo-colonialist attitude of the UN, which decides on the one hand that it will impose its will on sovereign nations. Let's remember then when the French had their Yellow Vest movement, in which countless protesters were and seriously injured. No international commission such as this was sent out to investigate France. We know, for instance, that in the UK, as soon as protests erupt, not riots, but protests, the protesters are routinely arrested and very long sentences in order to ensure that others won't join. Yet, this violation of basic is never condemned by So we're absolutely sick and tired of this attitude. And of course, we now know the Western mainstream media lies about whatever happens in Iran, exaggerates, only takes some sources which are obviously biased against the Iranian government. So I think that Iran is completely right in rejecting outright this commission. And I think most countries, most non-Western countries, should condemn this latest UN gimmick, essentially.
Elijah Magni, Iran has condemned a small group of Western countries, quote unquote, a small group of Western countries, for pushing the Human Rights Council to adopt their will in the form of an anti-Iran resolution. Talk to us more about Tehran's stance here.
Well, when we see countries united at the United Nations and trying to impose their will on the UN and on other countries present there relating to condemning Iran at the United Nations, and then we see among them there is Israel that is killing the Palestinians, they're violating their right, arresting children, condemning Palestinians in jail without taking them to trial. All that is a theater and a mockery at the end of the day. And we understand, as your guest rightly said, this continuous narrative is really becoming a bit boring, and with the aim that is obvious to the world today that the US is behind it, that the West is just following, and the aim is to impose on Iran their will. And it's not going to happen because they've learned nothing from Iran. Since 1979, Iran is maintaining consistent behavior with the West, saying, I want to deal with you, but not on, I will not submit to you. And the West wants the rest of the world to submit to to what they represent, 11% of the world population, and it's no longer possible today, particularly after the war in Ukraine, where the US unilateralism is a challenge, and Russia is saying to the US is enough. Now we see all the countries that are supporting Russia, they all fall in the same line of the Iranian policy that Iran has been adopting since 43 years. So the world is more aware what's happening, and all the theater that's happening at the United Nations and the mainstream media is not something that people can just take on board so easily as it used to happen before.
And Ms. Kara Mustafa, some observers believe that this is another component of the Iranophobia campaign pushed forth by some Western states. Would you agree with that notion?
Well, absolutely, and I think Iranophobia is blatant, is very brazen. They're not even hiding it anymore. I mean, every time there is a slight issue in Iran where people understandably may have issues with their government, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but anything extra encouraged, any protesters are encouraged to break the law, whereby had this happened on any street of Paris or London, the arrests would be en masse. We would see people stop the way they have been in Iran. Blatant Islamophobia. And I have to say that whilst I would at least have people who want to clear in a civilized manner, hasn't been the case in Iran. Things we've even seen on social media, very such as attacks, for instance, on that are being routinely pushed, turbans removed. You can see the actions of proud revolutionaries or protesters to impose human rights, but actually thugging the law and who are committed against their own. Actually, I think people who are seeing what is no sympathy whatsoever. So I think that when you see that, and when you see how they're being nudged by certain Western media, you realize that not only are these people the enemies of their country, but they're doing the bidding of Western countries who have had Iran in their eyes, in their sight for many, many decades now.
Elijah Magnier, when the issue of human rights comes to the fore, we've seen many cases of double standards regarding a number of Western countries and their allies. Has the issue of human rights, in your opinion, turned into a Western policy tool that is exploited when needed and ignored when it's more convenient?
Well, that was very obvious in the memo that Rex Tillerson, the former U.S. Secretary of State, received upon taking on board his job when he was told that we use human rights against countries like Iran, Korea, China, Russia, Venezuela, and Cuba, and we don't use it against our allies. So that is the double standard that the U.S. is not afraid of saying it. Now, when they expose it and they leak these memos, they're really challenging further the world and saying, we want to do what we want, and you do what we say, but you don't do what we do. So this is very obvious today that the American double standard and the Western double standard that just follow the American dictate without any objection. I mean, look, just a few months ago, Josep Borrell, when he received the letter from the Iranian, he said it is very reasonable and logical relating to the nuclear deal. But then he said, I hope the Americans will accept, and the Americans rejected. That's obvious that the Europeans have no will, and following the U.S. condemning Iran in the violation of human rights and just closing their eyes on what's happening in Israel, in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in other countries, it's an obvious double standard behavior.
Hafsa Qara Mustafa, has the issue of human rights been used as a political tool, not just against Iran, but in other instances as well?
Absolutely, and every time this is the same argument that is being brandished by Western media in order to justify. And can I just say that actually Iranian protesters, and in particular Iranians in the diaspora who are encouraging these riots, would do well to learn history. If you take, for instance, the events that we are watching now in Qatar, Qatar has done nothing but attempt to ingratiate itself with Western powers. It even collaborated with NATO in destroying fellow Arab country Libya. And yet look at the coverage that the Western media is making now of Qatar and its supposed violation of human rights, etc. So once the Western media decides to demonize you, there is nothing you can do. And also, I think if you remember the history of Iran with the Shah was very Western friendly, and yet at the end of his days, he couldn't even find a Western country to welcome him and offer him decent health care. And he died eventually in Egypt. So I think that my message, I think, here would be for protesters and for diaspora Iranians to realize that when you're supported by the West, these countries are not your friends, and they don't have your country or your people's best interest at heart. And history has time and time and time again confirmed that. So all these people who are telling Iranians that they're supporting their human rights and encouraging them, they are not doing that. They have their eyesight on Iran, on its resources. They love destabilization. They love war. They love brown blood. And that's all there is to know. And anyone falling for this charade of human rights would do well to read history.
Elijah Magnier, is there clear hypocrisy when it comes, we're focusing on the issue of hypocrisy on the issue of human rights. There's Canada, the U.S., France, their allies, Saudi Arabia, with the war in Yemen, what happened in Libya and Syria, the day-to-day rights violations endured by Palestinians. The list just goes on. What do we see here?
Well, we see, as you rightly said, the war in Libya. The mandate of the United Nations was given to protect the civilians. What they did, they removed completely removed the regime. What they are doing in Yemen since many years, starving the population, bombing the Yemeni, attacking the poorest country in the Middle East, and yet all the countries like Italy, France, Germany, Canada, the UK and the US, they are all involved with Saudi Arabia supplying weapons and contributing to the starvation of tens of millions of the population. All that is just not mentioned in the mainstream media. They don't want to talk about it. If we take what's happening in Iran, Mahsa Amini, the film that came out, the video at the police station, nobody wants to see it. Nobody wants to share it because it shows how she died from illness and from previous health courses. They just want to push the narrative because it's an opportunity to break Iran and to see if there is a possibility to change the regime. The only way to do that is the West is extremely good. They mastered all the officials and all the countries are put together with their long experience. We've seen that in Syria, how they manipulate the information, in Iran, in Libya, in Iraq, in Yemen, and they manipulate the information. So the best way is to strengthen your media to counter this information and to expose their lies, because the internet and social media is full of lies, and one needs to really have an aggressive stand against the mainstream media, because we have to acknowledge that this is really powerful and very strong and is capable of brainwashing the population.
Misgar Mustafa, following up on the issue of double standards, some of these countries that we just mentioned have been supporters of terrorism. They've carried out extrajudicial killings in other countries, and basically they've been involved in the complete tarnishing of other nations, and almost none of them have been held to account. Why is that?
Well, again, it's really the rule of double standards, and I think that there's no argument to that anymore. It's so well known, it's so well established, we're so familiar with it that really it's no longer a question of debating this. The bottom line now we know, and I think also the Ukraine-Russia war has exposed that to a certain extent, because if we follow mainstream news, we only have the Ukrainian narrative and the pro-Western narrative. There is no side to the Russian story, even though we know that in any conflict involving two major nations, there are always two sides to the story. So I think half of opinion, of the world's opinion, has now realized that whatever comes out of Western media is something to be taken with a pinch of salt. And I think that those who now do believe what is happening about Iran, they don't actually believe it. They simply want to be taken in by the lies, because we know that these are just propaganda operations designed to weaken Iran at all costs. And those who are collaborating from Iran in aiding these propaganda operations are doing it to bring down their own country. This is blatant double standards once again. And I think there really is no room for questioning or for even discussing this anymore. Saying this is a bit like stating that the earth is round. It's no longer something that we need to elaborate on, because I think now everyone is very much aware of that.
Elijah Magnier, it's hard to ignore the U.S.'s role here. Could this be, in your opinion, a continuation of the maximum pressure campaign against Iran?
It is, no doubt, that this maximum pressure campaign, it will continue and will be even more aggressive as long as Iran is saying, I need guarantee for the nuclear deal, I need to make sure that you're not going to reimpose the same sanctions again or impose new sanctions under different forms. So when the Europeans consider the Iranian demand of guarantee are reasonable and the Americans consider they rejected these conditions or these proposition, it means the Americans are not serious. So they want Iran to come to the table weak. They want Iran to come to the table without any guarantee so they can reimpose the sanction. And honestly, I don't see why the Americans will return the JCPOA. First of all, Iran said, I am not going to make a bomb. So why the Americans would bother and return to JCPOA if they believe, as even the head of the Israeli intelligence service, military intelligence service, said that he believed the one person is stopping Iran from not having the nuclear bomb is Sayyid Ali Khamenei. So if they believe that, why they should return to the JCPOA? If they believe that Iran is increasing its enrichment uranium from 3.75 to 20 to 60, starting with Natanz and then after that to Fordo, so what, you can open 10 other nuclear facilities as long as you're not going to go to 90% to make the bomb because there is a fatwa forbidding that. If they feel comfortable about it, why they would lift the sanctions? Lifting the sanction means Iran will return to support even further the axis of the resistance, support the oppressed population, support Palestine against Israel, support the Yemeni, support Hezbollah in Lebanon to maintain the border safe and prevent the Israelis from attacking, supporting even further Syria to prevent the Israelis from attacking. All these fall, including the return of tens of billions of dollars to the Iranian that are frozen in different banks, all that falls against the interests of the U.S. Therefore, I don't see really any benefit for the U.S. to return to the JCPOA when they have so much to lose and when Iran is offering this huge guarantee saying, I'm not going to produce a bomb, therefore you can be tranquil about it, and then we can deal. You're not dealing with an honest partner. You're dealing with an enemy that will always remain as an enemy.
Ms. Kara Mustafa, same question to you as well. Is this a continuation of the maximum pressure campaign against Iran exerted by the United States?
Absolutely, and I think they're looking to use any method possible, be it through hacking, be it through these propaganda operations. And I think that what is astonishing is how resilient Iran has been over the past years. I mean, just the sanctions have been actually very, very detrimental to Iran's economy, and yet Iran is still going strong. It has still developed numerous industries outside mere export of oil and gas and has shown the world that actually it could stand up. This is a 3,000-4,000 year old civilization that has been going on for many, many, many centuries and is likely to keep going for many, many more. And I think this is what the US in particular, a very young country with very little history, is unable to acknowledge, that Iran has been around for a very long time and has been able to withhold many crises in the past and will do so in the future, and it's still going strong. And I also think that whilst we do see a small minority of Iranians who are willing to play with the future of their country, I think overall the overwhelming majority of Iran's people will rally and realizes the danger that it faces in the face of these criminal countries that have destroyed nation after nation after nation. And therefore, despite all these backhanded techniques that are used by Western nations, in particular, obviously, by the US, I don't think it will succeed. I think Iran is facing a serious crisis at the moment, and it is facing some danger. But overall, I think it will come out of it stronger, as it has many, many times in the past.
All right, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels. Journalist and political commentator Hafsa Kara Mustafa, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.